From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this election day, we talk about last year's contested presidential election with Jeffrey Toobin. He's a legal analyst for ABC News and a staff writer for The New Yorker. His new book, Too Close to Call, investigates what happened behind the scenes. We'll also talk about Toobin's recent New Yorker article on the new anti-terrorism law. Also, novelist Ben Cheever talks about his new book, Selling Ben Cheever, about his experiences in various sales jobs, including selling sandwiches, computers, and cars. And David Bianculli reviews the new Fox TV series, 24. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. President Bush says he'll veto an anti-terrorism bill that calls for more than $40 billion in spending. The president made the promise at a White House meeting with congressional leaders. The Republican leadership, House Majority Leader Dennis Hastert and Senate Minority Leader Trent Lott, say they support the president's position. But Democrats and many Republicans on the House and Senate Appropriations Committees say the price tag will probably top $40 billion. White House officials have said if more money is needed, legislation providing it should wait until next year. The president said today that one important goal of the war on terrorism is to prevent groups like Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda from acquiring weapons of mass destruction. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The president says terrorist organizations have made it clear that they want to get their hands on nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. Mr. Bush said that is why it's important that the U.S. and other nations be, quote, relentless in their pursuit of bin Laden.
We will do everything we can to make sure he does not acquire the means to deliver weapons of mass destruction. If he doesn't have them, we will work hard to make sure he doesn't. If he does, we'll make sure he doesn't deploy them. And that's why it is so important that we continue our search for al-Qaeda in Afghanistan to hunt them down, to get them on the run.
The president also previewed a speech he'll deliver to the United Nations General Assembly in New York this weekend, saying that members of the coalition he's assembled must contribute more than sympathy or words. Don Gagne, NPR News, The White House.
Officials have scrapped plans to fumigate the entire Hart Senate office building, where a letter containing anthrax spores was opened in Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle's office last month. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Daschle says the Environmental Protection Agency has decided, in his words, there are too many dangers inherent in fumigating the entire eight-story Hart building with chlorine dioxide gas. So instead, they've come up with a multi-part plan to rid the building of lingering anthrax spores. Daschle's office and the adjoining suite of Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold and the building's ventilation system will be fumigated. Daschle says other offices will be treated with a foam.
Once that whole process is complete, is spot test every office to ensure that every part of the building has been inspected satisfactorily to ensure that there is no additional contamination.
50 senators have been displaced by the closure of Hart. It's likely to be late in the month before the building is reopened. Brian Naylor, NPR News, the Capitol.
Baseball owners voted today to eliminate two teams before the start of next season. They didn't say which ones. Commissioner Bud Selig said today it makes no sense for Major League Baseball to be in markets that don't make enough money to justify the expense. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 150 points, the Nasdaq up 41, the S&P 500 rose 16 points. You're listening to NPR News. Voters went to the polls today to select governors in New Jersey and Virginia and mayors in dozens of cities. In Cleveland, it's the first time in more than 10 years that incumbent Mayor Michael White is not on the ballot. From member station WKSU, Kevin Niedermeyer reports.
Longtime Mayor Michael White announced earlier this year that he would not seek re-election. So after an October primary featuring 10 candidates, today Cleveland voters are choosing between County Commissioner Jane Campbell and former Clinton administration education official Raymond Pierce. Election spokeswoman Maxine Greer says so far the turnout is ahead of recent mayoral elections, but still slightly behind Mayor White's first victory.
1989 at this point, during the day, the voter turnout was at 24%. So it looks like it either will match that number or outpace it.
If Jane Campbell wins the election, she would become Cleveland's first female mayor. A victory by Raymond Pierce would make him the city's third black mayor. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Niedermeyer in Cleveland.
Former Los Angeles Mayor Richard Reardon has officially entered the California governor's race. The ex-mayor made the announcement today at a rally after being introduced by actor Arnold Schwarzenegger. Reardon was the mayor of L.A. for 8 years until term limits prevented him from seeking a third term this year. Reardon joins two other significant contenders for the Republican nomination to try to unseat Democrat Governor Gray Davis. Hewlett-Packard's proposed takeover of Compaq Computer has hit a snag. The family and foundation of co-founder William Hewlett says they will vote their 5% stake against the deal. William Hewlett's son Walter says the new HP would be too heavily invested in the personal computer industry. I'm Frank Stachow.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, maker of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, the nature of what's to come, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this election day, we're going to look back at last year's presidential election, the election that wasn't decided until a Supreme Court decision 36 days later. My guest, Jeffrey Toobin, covered the election court cases for ABC News and The New Yorker magazine. After the Supreme Court decision, he continued to investigate what happened behind the scenes. Now he has a new book called Too Close to Call. Toobin is also the author of the best-selling books A Vast Conspiracy, about the impeachment of President Clinton, and The Run of His Life, about the O.J. Simpson trial. The recount story isn't over yet. A recount of the presidential vote was commissioned by a consortium of the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and CNN. The consortium expects to publish its results later this month. Jeffrey Toobin did not conduct a recount, but he concludes, based on his analysis of voting irregularities, that more people intended to vote for Gore than Bush. Jeffrey Toobin, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Good to be with you.
I'm sure you never expected to be reporting the results of your book during a war against terrorism. Some people think this is an inappropriate time to be going back over the contested election. What are your thoughts about going back over it in this context?
I don't know about inappropriate. I think it may be unfortunate for me, but I don't think George Bush is sitting up nights worrying about my book. I think this is a work of history. Too Close to Call is a book about something that happened last year and is an exploration of something that remains very important. But I'm not a politician. I'm not trying to get the vote overturned. George Bush is a legitimate president. He's the commander-in-chief of the military. But this was a very troubled and troubling election, and the events of September 11th don't change that.
Now, you say in your book that the way the Bush team and the Gore team went about their recount strategy said a lot about Bush and Gore and some of the differences between them. Can you talk about some of those differences as they manifested themselves during the recount?
Al Gore is a creature of Washington and the Capitol establishment. He is someone who wakes up every morning and reads the New York Times editorial page and really cares about how he's described there. He cares about being thought a bipartisan person, about being thought a statesman, and about the values that are transmitted over in establishment channels like the Times and the Washington Post editorial pages. George Bush is not a creature of Washington. He is someone who grew up outside that world and doesn't particularly care much about it or for it. And what that led to, and I think what it led to in our politics, both in the recount, during the Clinton years, and after September 11th, is that the Republican Party, National Republican Party, is a tougher, more ruthless organization than the Democrats are. And the Democrats spend a lot more time worrying about how they will be perceived rather than whether they will win. And I think that difference between the two parties is both profound and profoundly important in the resolution of this 36-day struggle.
Well, you say that the Bush team was willing to take risks to bet their careers and bear almost any burden for Republican victory. Your implication is that the Democrats were not willing to go that far for Gore. Was there a lack of interest or faith in Gore, or was there just a fear on the part of the Democrats that they would be perceived as challenging an election that shouldn't have been challenged?
I think there were two forces at work here, at least two. One relates to Gore and Bush specifically. The people around George Bush absolutely love the man. When you're talking about people like Karl Rove, Karen Hughes, Joe Albaugh, these are people who have staked their lives, their professional lives, on George Bush's success, and they were going to do what it took. If George Bush lost this election, their careers were deeply, deeply injured, if not ruined. The people around Al Gore did not have that same level of commitment. You know, of the two dozen or so people around Gore that I spoke to, precisely one wanted to see him run again. This is a guy, Al Gore, who received more votes for president than anyone in American history except Ronald Reagan in 1984, and his own people didn't even want to see him run again. I mean, there was just a personal magnetism gap between the candidates that was extremely important. The other factor is the Clinton years. For eight years, the Republican Party had been beside itself with loathing for Bill Clinton. And one time after another, he slipped out of their grasp. They managed to impeach him, but they never really closed the deal. The recount allowed all of that passion to be transferred to a new cause, winning this recount. And the Democrats had no comparable source of inspiration. And I think so those two points, the personal appeal of the candidates and the Clinton legacy, contributed to the passion gap a lot.
You write a little bit about how David Boies became Gore's lead lawyer. And I was interested to read that he wasn't necessarily the first choice.
No. Again, an example of how Gore did not have a network of people who were personally loyal to him. He and Boies had never met except for once briefly at a dinner. And Ron Klain and Walter Dellinger, who were two lawyers working part-time for Gore, they sort of sat around one day right near the beginning of the recount, and they said, well, who's the best lawyer we can get? And they came up with two names. One was David Boies, and the other was Joel Cohen, who was the head of the antitrust division in the Clinton administration. And so what they did was they had a race. Klain called Boies and Dellinger called Cohen, and they saw who would say yes first. As it turned out, Boies was readily available. Cohen had just gotten married and was on his honeymoon. So that's how David Boies was hired. It turned out to be a very good decision. Boies did a great job. But again, an example of how there was not a Gore network in place.
Did you talk to Boies directly, and did he have any regrets about his strategy?
I did speak to Boies at length, and I thought one of he was given a good deal of free rein, but some of his regrets related to an overall theme of too close to call. One of his big regrets was related to Seminole and Martin counties in Florida. And if you recall, Seminole and Martin were counties where the Republican Party organized an absentee ballot drive, and they distributed applications for absentee ballots, and they were sent in by Republican voters. Well, it turns out they were defective applications. They didn't ask for all the information, and Republican Party operatives were allowed to set up shop within these Republican Party offices and edit the applications that their people had made, clearly, it seems, in violation of how Florida law should work. Boies thought that they should have asked to have all those ballots thrown out, and it was several thousand ballots. Gore overruled him on that, saying, you know, we're committed to the policy of count all the votes. I'm not going to try to exclude these votes because that would be an inconsistent argument. The Bush campaign never had the slightest worry about making inconsistent arguments, but that was just the kind of self-censorship that Gore was involved, you know, characterized his effort. You know, you can argue that that was a statesmanlike, honorable thing to do. You can also argue that it made Al Gore the man on the lecture circuit that he is today.
You say in your book that it was David Boies' strategy to lose quickly in the Leon County Court, where Judge Ensander Saul was presiding, because he wanted to get to the Florida Supreme Court as quickly as possible. Was he confident he was going to lose in Judge Saul's court?
Well, Judge Sanders Saul's, this was, I mean, again, one of the wonderful things about covering a story like too close to, like the Florida recount and Too Close to Call, is you see these great characters. And you know, the Leon County Circuit Court is a Tallahassee court, medium-sized city. And Terry Lewis was a judge there. Wonderful, intelligent judge. Sanders Sauls was also a judge there who was actually, I think, one of the worst judges I have ever seen. And I think the Gore campaign recognized that they had very little chance in front of him. And if you recall, you know, by the time this was the contest part of the litigation, it was already December 1st before they got to Sanders Sauls, and they realized that they were really running out of time. So I thought Boies very cleverly did what good lawyers did, and he saw what his options were. He needed to get in front of the Florida Supreme Court because he thought his arguments would succeed there, just as he was certain they would fail in front of Judge Saul's. And he was absolutely right, and it was sort of a brilliant rope-a-dope kind of strategy, to use a Muhammad Ali reference, of just getting pounded in front of Judge Saul's. In fact, Judge Saul's ruled so overwhelmingly against the Gore campaign that it was easier for him to win, for Gore to win in front of the Florida Supreme Court, which he did win 4-3, only to be overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court.
So since it was David Boies' strategy to lose quickly in Judge Saul's court, did he try to not make a strong case or to just make as strong a case as he could in as brief a time as possible?
Well, he tried to make a strong case, but the thing that he did that was so clever was to do what lawyers say, make a record. His top priority was to get the ballots physically in evidence, get the disputed ballots from Miami-Dade County, from Palm Beach County, get them physically in evidence, because he knew that that the Florida Supreme Court would be uncomfortable with the idea of having these ballots in evidence, physically in front of Judge Saul's, and not look at them. And the Florida Supreme Court reacted, I think, quite properly, viscerally to that, and ultimately part of what the Florida Supreme Court ruled was you got to look at the ballots.
My guest is Jeffrey Toobin. He's the author of the new book, Too Close to Call. He's a legal analyst for ABC News and a staff writer for The New Yorker. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Jeffrey Toobin is my guest. He's written a new book called Too Close to Call, an investigation of the contested presidential election. Toobin is a legal analyst for ABC News and a staff writer for The New Yorker. Why was James Baker the head of the Republican effort in the recount? Why was he chosen?
Because Bush is a smart person. in simple terms, the reason why he was chosen was, if you recall, on election night, really, it was still the middle of the night, the Gore campaign recruited Warren Christopher to come from Los Angeles and be the initial representative of the Gore campaign in Florida. As the Bush people sat around, Don Evans, who was the campaign chairman, now Secretary of Commerce, Joe Albaugh, they said, well, who do we have who is a comparable figure? Well, in poker, they matched Gore and then raised him one, because they said, well, we have a former Secretary of State, James Baker. But unlike Warren Christopher, James Baker was also an extremely savvy political operative. James Baker had done something that no other person in American history has done. He ran five consecutive major party campaigns for president. From 76 to 92, he ran every single Republican campaign. That kind of experience, you know, is something money can't buy. So he had the stature as a Secretary of State, but also the street-fighting savvy of a campaign manager.
What are some of the new things you learned about James Baker's strategy?
Well, James Baker was hired on the Wednesday after the election, and he got a private plane with Joe Alba, and they flew to Tallahassee together. And they had a young staffer on the plane who gave them a briefing on what little they knew about the situation there. And just before they landed, Baker said to Alba, you know, this thing is going to end in the United States Supreme Court. This was on November 8th, one day after the election. And Baker had the sort of big picture savvy to recognize that this story was really just too big for Florida. And he knew that the Supreme Court couldn't help but get involved. The other thing James Baker said from the very beginning is, we need political people involved here. I want to see protesters in the streets. I want to see people outraged about this. You know, Baker was very deeply involved in the legal strategy, but he also didn't hesitate to exert political pressure. He was behind the idea of getting surrogates in Florida. Everybody will probably remember Governor Mark Grasco of Montana, George Pataki of New York, Christy Whitman of New Jersey, how they all came down to Florida and set up shop there. That was because Baker recognized that this was not just a legal process, but it was a political process as well.
What's one of the most interesting things you feel you learned in your research for your new book that had not gone reported by the press?
To me, what always interests me is going behind the scenes, and particularly in an institution like the United States Supreme Court. And I learned something that I thought really was illustrative, not just of the Supreme Court, but of the whole recount. Just to refresh your recollection, everyone remembers the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that George Bush's equal protection rights had been violated. Well, in an initial draft of her dissenting opinion, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg said that not only didn't she think George Bush's equal protection rights were violated, the only person's rights she thought violated were those of black voters in Florida. And Justice Antonin Scalia, one of the leading members of the majority, was so outraged by this claim that he wrote Justice Ginsburg a memo saying, you know, you're using Al Sharpton tactics in the Supreme Court. You're playing the race card and you shouldn't do it. So what did Ruth Bader Ginsburg do? Well, she removed that passage from her dissenting opinion. Scalia essentially intimidated her into not playing the race card. And I think it illustrates the differences, again, between the Republicans and the Democrats. The Republicans were willing to do what it took to win this election. Justice Ginsburg, like Al Gore, like Warren Christopher, was worried about how he was being perceived and how she was being perceived, and so she shied away from the confrontation. That, to me, tells you a little something about the Supreme Court and a lot about the differences between Democrats and Republicans.
My guest is Jeffrey Toobin. He's a legal analyst for ABC News and a staff writer for The New Yorker. His new book is called Too Close to Call, The 36-Day Battle to Decide the 2000 Election. One of the more controversial figures in the Florida recount was Catherine Harris, the Secretary of State in Florida. Her office is going to be abolished next year, and she will also be running for Congress next year. You conclude in your book that she was biased in favor of Bush, that she politicized her office. What leads you to that conclusion?
Well, you know, you ask about new things that I learned in the book, and I have to say this may be the single most shocking fact to me, anyway. Everybody remembers that there was what was called a machine recount, an automatic recount. The election was within 0.5%, so that under Florida law, there had to be an automatic recount of all the votes by machine in the immediate 2 days after the election. And this is what prompted Republicans to say, James Baker must have said it 50 times, the votes have been counted and recounted. And I think many of us simply took that for granted. But what I learned when I went behind the scenes in Catherine Harris's office was that there was no complete recount of the votes. Fully a third, a quarter of all the votes in the state, 1.25 million votes, were never recounted, to this day have never been recounted, because Catherine Harris's office didn't want to take the chance that those votes would turn out to favor Gore. I mean, Harris's office, time after time after time, operated like a wholly owned subsidiary of the Republican campaign, which is what it was. And again, it was no coincidence. There is a great sort of Mistopheles character named Max Stepanovich, sort of a Florida lobbyist, former chief of staff for a Republican governor, who called up the Bush campaign on the day after the election and said, "Put me to work. How can I? What can I do?" And the Bush campaign sent Stepanovich to sit by Catherine Harris's side, as he did for the next several weeks, making sure that she ruled every single time in Bush's favor, which is precisely what she did.
What do you think her odds are for winning the race next year?
Oh, I don't think the odds are much more than 100% that she's going to win. I mean, it's a heavily Republican district. Name recognition, to put it mildly, is not a problem for Catherine Harris in Florida. And she's going to win in a walk.
Now, today is Election Day. Have we done anything substantive in terms of election reform since last year?
Well, you know, in the intense controversy over Florida's recount, there was one point of virtually universal agreement, which was that our election laws are a disgrace, our voting technology is terrible, and we need to change that. So 1 year later, we have done almost absolutely nothing about that, and there are no signs that anything's going to be done. Florida is a honorable exception. Florida has done a serious reform of its election laws, and I think a lot of the problems that we saw there will not recur. But in other states, at the federal level, absolutely nothing has been done. And in an era when there's always a lot of competition for government resources, it's always better to just sort of put it off and ignore it. And if no one's pestering you to change, it won't change. And it hasn't changed yet.
Jeffrey Toobin is the author of the new book, Too Close to Call. He's a legal analyst for ABC News and a staff writer for The New Yorker. In the second half of the show, we'll talk with him about the new anti-terrorism law, which he wrote about in last week's New Yorker. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publishers of Stephen Hawking's The Universe in a Nutshell, the sequel to A Brief History of Time. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, what does a writer do when he loses his publisher and fails to sell his third novel? We talked to novelist Ben Cheever about his new book, Selling Ben Cheever. Also, David Bianculli reviews the new TV series 24, and we continue our conversation with Jeffrey Toobin about the new anti-terrorism law.
We'll be right back.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jeffrey Toobin. We're going to talk about the new anti-terrorism law. Toobin is a legal analyst for ABC News and a staff writer for The New Yorker. Earlier, we talked about his new book, Too Close to Call, The 36-Day Battle to Decide the 2000 Election. You had a very interesting article in last week's New Yorker on the new anti-terrorism law and on Michael Chertoff, the Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Criminal Division of the Justice Department. And he thought that information sharing within American intelligence was a major problem. Describe the kind of problem that he felt he was up against when, after September 11th, when the real hardcore anti-terrorism investigation began.
Well, since the 1970s, there have been really two different tracks that wiretapping and eavesdropping is conducted on in American law enforcement. There is one track that is what's criminal law enforcement. When the FBI thinks that the mafia is using a social club, they tell a judge, we have probable cause to believe there is a crime, evidence of a crime in this place, and they get what's called a permission for a bug to be placed there. That's one track, the law enforcement track. The other track is national security, foreign intelligence, where the FBI says, you know, we need to put a bug in the Russian embassy because it'll help our foreign policy, and we believe it's a foreign intelligence target. That goes to a separate court called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Court, FISA. They get what's called a FISA warrant. Well, what September 11th really illustrated to a lot of people is that the difference between national security and law enforcement is kind of a meaningless distinction now, because when you have foreign groups and foreign countries involved in committing crimes on our soil, as happened in the most dramatic way on September 11th, there is no distinction between what's foreign and what's domestic. The problem is that for foreign intelligence taps, the bar tends to be a lot lower. It's a lot easier to get permission to do a foreign intelligence tap. So civil libertarians were worried that if everything was a foreign intelligence tap, the FBI would simply be tapping everything. So what happened was, in this anti-terrorism bill, was that it made it easier for foreign intelligence information to be shared with law enforcement. And while that will lead to, I think, some expansion of tapping and some greater dissemination of the information gathered in those taps, it did not strike me, and it didn't strike 99 members of the U.S. Senate, significant infringement on civil liberties, as we've seen in this country in the past.
You give an example in your article of a person that the FBI wanted to investigate, but they couldn't get a search warrant. Would you describe that example? This was searching the computer of a French Moroccan who... go ahead.
Right. This is the fellow in Minnesota, Mr. Massoui, who in August of this year, he was one of the famous people who went to a flight school in Minnesota and said, I want to learn how to steer an airplane, but I don't want to learn how to take off and land. And he also offered to pay his fee at the flight school in cash. The system, in many respects, worked very well. The flight school alerted the local FBI. The local FBI then arrested Mr. Massoui on an immigration violation, and he's been in jail since August. He was not involved in the September 11th hijackings, although some people think he may have been destined to be the 20th hijacker. But what happened during the period of August to September is some in the FBI locally wanted to get a search warrant to examine his computer and see if there was any evidence there. And FBI headquarters said, well, we don't want to do that, because we don't know whether that would be a foreign intelligence tap, and then we couldn't share it in a criminal investigation. So there was no search of his computer done before September 11th. And the problem potentially, I mean, the theory was is that maybe they would have learned something to prevent the attack. They've since examined the hard drive, and it probably wouldn't have led to stopping the attack. But that whole notion of this sort of separate systems, the problems in it, was illustrated by this strange hesitation in the Massoui case.
What are some of the history behind the difference of the standard that you need to get a warrant for a foreign case and for a local, you know, a domestic crime case?
What's interesting is in law enforcement, the standards have been pretty clear all along that, you know, you have to tell a judge you have probable cause to believe there'll be evidence of a crime, and that's how you get a law enforcement tap or bug placed. The foreign intelligence worked very differently. Until the 1970s, the FBI didn't ask for permission at all. Whenever they wanted to bug an embassy or bug a foreign intelligence target, they just went ahead and did it. But what happened during the 1970s was the courts started to say, you know, there is no way on American soil that you can just bug willy-nilly, even if it's a foreign target. There have to be some rules in place. And they established, and Congress in 1978 passed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that set up this system for obtaining warrants on foreign intelligence targets. So it was only since 1978 that these two tracks existed. It is a classic Cold War artifact, because in 1978, when the government was thinking about foreign intelligence targets, they weren't really thinking about law enforcement at all, because what we were thinking about was getting evidence about what the Russians were up to, and that was not a law enforcement issue at all. That was a national security diplomatic issue. What has happened in 2001 is that any issue relating to terrorism is now both a foreign policy issue and a domestic law enforcement issue of the highest importance. And the grounds for that separation simply don't exist anymore.
So the new anti-terrorism law won't make it any easier to get a tap on someone who's alleged to be in the mafia. It will only make it easier to get a tap on somebody who's alleged to be a terrorist.
That's right. And it somewhat expands the definition of terrorist, and that has caused some civil libertarians some concern. And it makes it easier for the government to share the results of national security taps with law enforcement, which again causes civil libertarians some upset. But, you know, when I set out to write this New Yorker story, I was thinking in terms of the great periods of repression we've had in this country during and after wartime, things like the Red Scare after World War I, the internment of the Japanese during World War II, Nixon's surveillance of anti-war protesters around the time of Vietnam. And when you place this anti-terrorism bill against those really dramatic violations of civil liberties, you know, I was left somewhat comforted. I did not think that this was a wholesale violation of Americans' rights.
Does the new anti-terrorism law affect communications and information sharing between the FBI and the CIA?
Well, it almost did. Here was an example of where the administration's proposal was cut back and limited. The administration originally proposed that wiretaps or bugs, surveillance that had been conducted by foreign governments, which, you know, goes through our CIA and is reported to the American government, could be used in American courts. But civil libertarians rebelled against this idea, and it was dropped because, you know, foreign intelligence collection in foreign countries is conducted under very wild and woolly circumstances. I mean, if we think our intelligence agencies don't respect human rights, you know, you talk about like the French intelligence. I mean, those people really play for keeps. And the Congress decided that they weren't going to essentially contract out our civil liberties to foreign intelligence operations, and that part was cut from the legislation.
Well, Jeffrey Toobin, I thank you so much for talking with us.
Always a pleasure.
Jeffrey Toobin is a staff writer for The New Yorker and a legal analyst for ABC News. His new book, Too Close to Call, is about last year's presidential election. Coming up, how Ben Cheever started selling books in addition to writing them. This is Fresh Air. Ben Cheever was used to being a customer, not a salesman, but for 5 years he worked in various chain stores, selling sandwiches, computers, cars, and books. Cheever is better known for writing books than selling them. He's the author of 3 books of fiction and the editor of a collection of letters by his father, the late writer John Cheever. Ben is married to New York Times book critic and former film critic Janet Maslin. Before writing books, Ben Cheever worked as an editor at Reader's Digest. In 1995, he was having trouble getting his third novel published. He decided to write another book on a problem a growing number of Americans were dealing with, trying to get and keep a job in the service economy. Although most of the jobs he landed were in sales, he worked briefly as a security guard. I asked him about the training he was given.
Well, we were told to do almost nothing. I mean, a lot of our training was not to do anything. We were told not to arrest anyone. We were told because if you make an arrest and the person is not convicted of the crime you're arresting them for, then you can be sued for false arrest. We were told not to think for ourselves. We were told to wear our uniforms and be neat and write everything down we saw, but not to interfere. And we were also told not to steal anything, and that we'd be watched very carefully, and to make sure that no other employees stole anything, because that was a big concern of the employers, I think.
Was it a dangerous job? Did you ever feel at risk?
Well, in fact, I ended up guarding a perfume plant for 2 nights. I was the only person there. When I first arrived there, I said to the people who were showing me around, I said, perfume, who's going to steal perfume? And they said, well, we have another plant in Canada that was held up by a bunch of guys with ski masks carrying shotguns. And then they went home and left me in the car. And they told me no one was going to come. They said, nobody else is going to come on the campus except the vice president might show up, they said. And I said, well, how will I know he's the vice president? And they said, you'll know, he looks like the vice president. But otherwise, no one's supposed to show up. And just before I went off duty, which was at 6 a.m. the next morning, a truck showed up. And I was terrified. I thought, I had no gun. I didn't have a stick. I didn't have anything. And I was wearing this blue uniform that said security all over it. And, I was frightened.
What happened?
Well, I called 911, which is what I was told to do. And a police car came over and, they came quickly and they were very respectful and nice to me. And they went over and questioned this guy in the truck. And then they drove. Then they came back and they said he has authority, and I didn't know what that meant. And then they left, and I drove over, and there was this guy, and he was up on the top of a big truck, and I looked up at him, and I said, I'm the guy who called the police. And he said, what were you doing? There's no one ever, never anyone here. And I said, well, I'm guarding the place. And he said, you thought some knucklehead was trying to steal your garbage. And then I realized that it was a truck picking up a dumpster. It had a dumpster on the back of it. But I was terrified.
You must have felt like you were taking a big risk, or at least you were exposing yourself to the possibility of a big risk for pretty low pay. How much did you get paid per hour?
Well, I think it was I was driving my own car and paying for my own gas, and I think if you factor that out, I was probably making close to minimum wage, maybe a little bit less than minimum wage. And the place had been, the reason they'd hired the security company is because the place had been cased out by a couple of, convicted felons. So, who'd come in with a special thing to open the gate. So there was reason to be concerned. Yes, I might have been killed for almost no money. And during the course, during the preparation, the one-day preparation, the instructor had said, you watch movies and we don't come off very well. He said, we're always getting tied up. We're always getting dead. I mean, he was talking about the image, but it planted in my mind a genuine fear.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ben Cheever. His new book is called Selling Ben Cheever, Back to Square One in a Service Economy. And it's about a series of low-paying jobs that he took on. Now, one of the positions that you took on was selling cars at an auto mall. And I think customers are probably more suspicious of car salesmen than any other kind of salesman, probably because the price of a car is so expensive. And there's so much play in that price. You have to negotiate. And that probably the better the salesman is, the more trouble you might be in terms of the price. What are some of the rules that you learned when you were selling cars about how to play a customer?
Well, you were told never, ever to mention the price. We were memorized four bypasses, which were things you said when they asked you, but how much is that car gonna cost me? You'd say, well, I'm not sure that's exactly the car you want. Every car has a different price. But I'm sure we'll get you just the right price. But first, let's find exactly the car you want. You wanted to get them in love with a car before you even talked about price for two reasons. One is that moved them toward a sale. And the other was that if you give them the price, they can stalk out and go to another dealership and use that to lower a price somewhere else. So that was a lie you were instructed to tell, that you didn't know the price of the car when, in fact, you had some idea what the price was.
And I know, like, when you're buying a car, once you do get to talking about price, the salesman always says, when you say that you want a lower price than the one you're being offered, the salesman always says, let me check with the manager. And he goes to the back office, or she goes to the back office, comes back a few minutes later, and gives you a new price. When you did that, did you really meet with the manager, or did you just spend a couple of minutes in an empty room pretending like you were talking with the manager?
No, I met with the manager, but we had a couple of things we did. One is the manager had a lease and loan computer, and he would be working out the monthly payments. Most of the people I sold cars to were taking out a loan or leasing it. So it was a month, we were working on a monthly payment. So that had to be recalculated. But what you did when you got close is then you came, since I was new, and actually they did this with people who'd been there for a while, you came out with the manager together to the cubicle where the customers were. The manager sat in your chair behind the desk, and you sat with the customer. You double team them like this. So it's almost like a football play. It was also done in the electronics stores. You get a couple of people on your side, and that adds the weight of more people, and they're more inclined to buy a car.
And that way the person who's selling to you appears to actually be on your team and appears to
That's
be helping
right.
you, but they're actually selling you.
That's right.
So how good were you at selling things because you were going to make a larger profit on it?
Well, that's the game. I had a thing, and I mentioned this in the book. I'd sold an old man a car at a tremendous markup. An old man I liked, a car at a tremendous markup, which was the equivalent of, you know, hitting a home run with four, you know, with three people on base. And I was very pleased with myself. And I went to a party at which there were people of my class. And I told this story expecting to be congratulated. And everyone was horrified because they sympathized with the old man. Well, but if you're a car salesman and you don't push the price up, you're not only going to make any money, but you're not playing the game. That's the game. It's like playing baseball and saying, I don't want to hit the ball with this bat because it's going to hurt the ball. That's the game.
How many jobs did you hold over the period that you were writing this book?
Well, it depends on how you count. Somewhere between 12 and 15, 16, I guess.
What's the longest you lasted at any one job?
The longest was car sales, and that was the job I liked best, too. And they were sorry to see me go. I love it when they're sorry to see me go. I said to my manager, I said, well, you spent a lot of time training me. And he said, and I said, and I'm sorry to let you down. And he said, no, he said, I think you could sell cars, he said.
What did you like selling cars the best of everything that you tried?
Well, we had a lot of, there was a lot of good feeling. There was a lot of joking and back, you know, padding among the other salesmen. I used to get up to leave at night, and the man in the cubicle next to me used to say, "You say the dead won't rise again, but you haven't seen Ben Cheever at quitting time," because I used to rush out with such alacrity. And there was a lot of good feeling there, and you had a lot of freedom. If somebody was really a stinker to you in a car store, you could turn on and walk away. If somebody's really a stinker to you in an electronics store, you have to put up with it. And they, you know, sometimes someone will come in and take a whole morning and spend that whole morning torturing you and buy nothing. There are, you know, chain store sadists.
What are you doing now with your days?
Well, I'm writing a novel and. But I do miss this, and I want to find. I need a place to be engaged, more engaged in the world than I am as a full-time writer. These people that I worked with, that were my friends for that brief period of time, sometimes 3 months, sometimes 2 days, it just made me feel better about everything, because they were in situations much more difficult than my own. And not only were they staying at work and doing these jobs for which they were disdained in many cases, but they were also funny and helpful and humorous. And they were always helping me out. You know, at the computer store, I'd have trouble writing up my ticket because my handwriting's so bad. And the woman at the register would not only fix it, but she'd say, "Oh, it'll be all right, honey." You know, they were nice. And you're around those people for 8 to 12 hours in a day sometimes. And you go home and you feel so good about people. You really think, hey, you know, we're not such a bad group.
Well, Ben Cheever, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks very, very much for having me.
Ben Cheever's new book is called Selling Ben Cheever. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new series 24. This is Fresh Air. Tonight, the Fox Network presents the premiere of a weekly dramatic series called 24. It's gotten the best advance reviews of any new TV series this season. TV critic David Bianculli says the buzz is justified.
The title 24 in this new Fox series refers to both the time frame of the story and the number of episodes intended to tell it. The gimmick behind the show, and it's a simple yet brilliant one, is that we watch a federal agent named Jack Bauer, played by Kiefer Sutherland, going through the most intense day of his life. It's literally a day, 24 hours beginning at midnight, and each one-hour episode of the series plays out in real time. Between now and the end of the season, 24 episodes of 24. What makes Jack's day so intense that he won't even stop to sleep? At home, his teen daughter sneaks out and disappears. At work, at his Los Angeles anti-terrorist unit, he's called in and given orders to stop the planned assassination of an African-American senator from California, a prominent presidential candidate. Jack also is told, in the justifiably paranoid language of the X-Files, to trust no one. That's what makes the day so intense. Jack is tracking a terrorist killer at work and a wayward daughter at home. What makes the show so intense is that 24 uses split-screen visuals, a relentlessly clicking digital clock, and an amazingly breathless pace to launch the story and the show. 24 isn't a TV series. It's a thrill ride. And it's a ride that's already running at full speed as you're asked to hop aboard. It starts in the middle of the night, in the middle of the story, and asks you, dares you, to hang on and keep up. What you get, very quickly, is that Jack is trying to repair a broken marriage and has just moved back in with his wife and daughter. That at work, he's either had an affair or contemplated one with an attractive coworker. And that when his boss gives Jack the assignment to head the anti-assassination task force, it's because Jack already has made waves and enemies within his own shop.
There may be an element inside the agency involved with the hit on Palmer.
What?
For the next 24 hours, I want you all over this. You're going to be interfacing with every division in the region.
I am the last person on the face of this planet that you want to bring something like this to.
I don't agree.
Richard, I built a case against three of our own agents and busted them for taking bribes. If there's a conspiracy in the agency to kill David Palmer, I'll never get anywhere near it.
Well, you'll have to, Jack. Because you're the only guy that I can trust.
Sutherland is terrific in the leading role, and the cast around him shows plenty of fire. Leslie Hope is the wounded wife, Alicia Cuthbert is the rebel daughter, Sarah Clark is the sexy co-worker, and Dennis Haysbert and Penny Johnson-Gerald as the black senator and his wife. Off-camera, the creators of 24 are Joel Cerno, whose credits include Wise Guy, and Robert Cochran, whose credits include TV's La Femme Nikita. These are guys who know long story arcs and subtle intrigue inside and out. After the first hour of 24, you're desperate to see more, which is a very good sign. The only concern about the first hour is whether the show can keep up the pace and the quality in subsequent episodes. If it can, and if viewers keep watching, 24 stands to become a truly remarkable television series.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Roberta Sherrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howe, Patty Leswing, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a track from a new CD featuring singer Rebecca Kilgore, accompanied by pianist and songwriter Dave Frischberg. They've performed several times on Fresh Air, including on a couple of the programs in our American Popular Song series. Their new CD is called The Starlit Hour.
Thanks for the memory of rainy afternoons, swingy Harlem tunes, motor trips and burning lips and burning toast and prunes. How lovely it was. Thanks for the memory of candlelight and wine, castles on the Rhine, your cozy chair and parties where we sang Sweet Adeline. How lovely it was. Many's the time that we feasted, and many's the time that we fasted. Oh well, it was swell while it lasted. We did have fun and no harm done. And thanks for the memory of sunburns at the shore, nights in Singapore. You might have been a bring down, but you never were a bore. So thank you so much.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Eastside Digital, for the newly remastered CDs Switched on Bach and Well-Tempered Synthesizer by Wendy Carlos, online at hearful.com, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we listen to President Lyndon Johnson's secretly recorded tapes about the war in Vietnam and other subjects, and we talk with presidential historian Michael Beschloss. He's just edited his second volume of LBJ's tapes. It covers the years 1964 to 65. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.